Hi, I'm Helene Meisler. I'm a columnist for RealMoney.com. And today my panic is that I think NASDAQ is going to rally, and I'm afraid it won't.
Hello, my friend. How are you?
I, as always, am fabulous. I had a pre-pod poop. PPP. It's like a PPP loan from me to the toilets.
You know, we all have those. The triple P's.
I edit that out. No, I'm kidding. If I said it, it counts.
Yep.
Howard doesn't delete his pods. But anyways, nope. there's a morning pod, and I am loaded with coffee.
That's a good thing. So you are going to be hyper.
Well, part of the game, Knut. Is yes. I'd like to live, you know, I wake up at 5.
Yes.
I write. You know, the dog wakes up with me now at 5 because I've fucked up the schedule of my dog. And so if it hears me, it thinks food because, you know, I'll feed the dog at random hours. Anyways, so Lindsay gets up with me the minute I roll out of bed. She comes out of wherever she's hiding it near Ellen and a cocoon that she digs up in an area of Ellen's warm body. And pops up, shakes her ears, and is looking for food. And so I have to attend to this, otherwise she'll drive me nuts. So I feed her, which means she's ready for her next nap, and I can go about my first cup of coffee, throwing cold water on my face. Are we at a time?
No,
you're
not
looking
yet.
At me like this isn't my show.
You got another 3 or 4 seconds. Go for it, buddy.
So I make my coffee, pop an Adderall, 5 milligrams, people, not like 60 milligrams. I'm waiting for my system to do its thing. And some days it's 10 minutes, but today was a couple hours late. I took an extra 5 milligrams for this because I have a great guest. And I can't believe if she hears this opening, she may nix the pod. But anyways, I'm a super fan I don't think she'll be thrilled about me saying this because it'll imply she's not young. I won't say old, but not young. Because I've been following her work since the 90s at thestreet.com. I don't know how to describe her, so I'm going to let her describe herself. But a master of the markets, a fan of the markets, a mentor to tens of thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people, that like to think clearly about the markets and learn about technical analysis and price and sentiment, Helene Meisler. And she is in St. Louis. Which, so I don't even, do they have phones? Hopefully the internet connection works in St. Louis. Is that in the United States, can it?
She's on a satellite link.
Satellite link, Starlink from Elon Musk from St. Louis. Helene!
Here I am.
Okay. So hopefully you didn't hear any of that. And you're still willing to do the pod. How exciting is this for you? And you know, you've met Cramer, you've met all the big shots in finance. Is this one of the big thrills?
It is, of course. Of course, I have to say, I'm honored that you invited me. Thank you.
I'm so excited. Have you ever LOL'd at anything I said? Because I know you kind of get the shtick.
I have. You know, I loved when you were biking. Was it last fall?
Uh-huh.
Or was it earlier this year? And you were biking and you were showing us how hard it was. And I told you to keep at it.
You do. You're like a, you're just like a steward of goodwill on Twitter and in your writing. What was the moment that you knew the markets, like, is there a moment that when you were young, that you were like, oh my God, I love the markets?
It's a great question. I went to work on Wall Street in 1982.
So let me do the math here. I'm going to just do the math because I'm Karnak. So 82, so you're probably 18 or 19 back then. So 82, 92, 102, 240. So you're in your late 20s.
Right, 29. Exactly.
Okay, but now I know. Okay, so 82, you go to work in the markets with a pencil, right, and a highlighter.
Pencil and a highlighter and paper. Don't forget the paper.
And tape, because you had to tape the paper together to do long-term charts.
You have to tape the paper. And when they go off the top and they go off the bottom, you have to tape.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of taping going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I only went to work in the stock market because 1982 was a terrible job market, and they were the only place hiring.
Interesting. And was this in New York or?
It was.
Okay. So you went, where'd you go to school?
My first job was at Cowan. I went to school at Pace University.
It's in New York, right?
In New York. And then I went to work at Cowan and I liked it. I couldn't believe how much I liked it, I have to say. And I was really, really lucky that it was so early in a bull market. And because the 70s were so bad in the markets, nobody had gone to work on Wall Street for years.
Interesting.
So they were just happy to have somebody who was interested and willing to learn.
And so you had to take your test, or did you go on to the, what side of the table did you go to? Did you have to take your series tests? And right, because the 70s were inflationary, so that we'll talk about that today, because we haven't seen what we're seeing since then, if we can go back in the Wayback Machine. And so were you hired to be in the sales side or the research side?
I was hired to be on the institutional sales side as an assistant, which basically translates as gopher.
Right. Same as today.
I mean, I knew nothing. I didn't know the difference between a stock and a bond.
Hmm. And so you got to take your series 63 or 7?
Series 7, 67, series 7 and 63. But that didn't come until, I think, 1983 I took it.
And do you remember the first stock you bought?
Ah, I do. Compaq.
Ah. And did it work? Probably worked because it was the 80s.
It did because it was just after the IPO and there was a salesman there who I thought was quite a good stock picker. And he said to me, I think you want to buy this stock. And so I did. And I made some good money on it. I don't remember how much, but I do remember I made money on it.
And so flash forward to today, what is the biggest difference 40 years in the markets? Because one of the things that makes you cool in following you is, first of all, my great friends who I trust immensely around who to follow on social and who's good at technical analysis is JC and Phil Perlman. Phil's like my brother. And JC, I think, speaks in English around a very complicated, you know, around prices. So who was your first mentor that got you going along technical analysis?
Oh, that was Justin Mamus. He came to work for the firm in the mid 80s and I think it was 84. And after listening to him and watching his work for, you know, 6 months or 9 months or something like that, I went to management and said, I really would love to work with Justin and I would love to learn what he does.
Wow.
And again, they were so accommodating. I was very blessed with how I started my career. And they said, okay, I could work with Justin and I could cover. By then I had my Series 7 and I was covering some accounts. So I could cover like the tiny little hedge funds that nobody wanted to cover.
So still
because,
on the
you know,
sales
they were managing
side, not,
$10 million.
So still on the sales side, not on the technical analysis side.
Well, yeah. I mean, we were all sort of together. We were research and sales. We all sat together.
Got it.
And so I worked for Justin and I covered, I think it was four or five literally tiny little hedge funds, none more than $10 million.
Right.
And who had an interest, and they were all hedge funds who also had an interest in technical analysis and sort of learning technical analysis. Because remember, back then, a lot of people didn't really know what it was.
I still don't think a lot of people do. So can you define it for the person listening? Because my audience is like trend followers and early stage investors and stock twits community who loves technical analysis. But how do you define it?
Well, I think it's analysis. So it's the same way a fundamental analyst will take a look at what are the revenues and what are the earnings and what are the margins and all those sorts of numbers. And they're sort of the internal numbers of what's going on with the company.
Mm-hmm.
I take a look at the market and I look at the internal breakdown of how the market's numbers have gotten where they've gotten. And so I look at the breadth of the market. I look at sentiment. I look at, obviously, trend lines. And so what I'm looking for is what I call the internals. And I want to know if the internals are supporting the price move. So to me, that's the analysis.
Yes. I've always said to JC, because, you know, it's a new generation and now another, you know, I used to say to JC in 2010s, oh my God, we got, you know, because it was just Twitter and StockTwits, not even Reddit really, or Wall Street Bets and Discord. I was like, dude, we got to change the language. And crypto people have the same problem, I think. They're speaking in like tongues. If they want it widespread adoption, they got to like market better. And I've always said technical analysis is the worst marketed. Like you say fundamental analysis and people, they may make fun of the Fed and you can't do fundamental analysis, but everybody knows what it means. If you say
yeah, but do they know what EBITDA is?
Of course they don't, but it's like one of those fake things. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to where we want to go. Give a shit about okay. fundamental analysis. I don't trust anybody's work. I don't trust spreadsheets because everybody's, it makes them dance to how they want. So I believe that price action, market internals, money flow, technical, works way better. But it's the worst marketed system or worst marketed language of all time. So I've always gone to JC, and why don't we just call it, and why don't we just call it chart art? You're looking at a chart and you're studying the art of all the, you know, that goes in behind it. What is it that makes people cringe when they hear technical analysis?
Well, I think that in the last, let's just say 25 years, you've have a lot of people call themselves technical analysts, and what they really are chart readers. Mm-hmm. They're just looking at a chart, drawing a line. They throw up, you know, these moving average lines on the chart, and they're like, you know, well, the 9-day moving average, my head starts spinning because mm-hmm. that's not what I do. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are chart readers and there are analysts.
And, okay, I like that.
And I think there's a big difference. And I think, so in the world I grew up in, most people did what I do, which is analyze the internals. And in the world that we've seen in the last 25 years is a lot more people are chart readers. I hate to say it, but they use a lot of computerized indicators, which there's nothing wrong with that, but there's always the flavor of the day. You know, today it's RSI. 10 years ago, everybody cared about MACD. Maybe 10 years before that, they cared about stochastics, you know.
Very good
point. It always
point.
Seems to change.
But that you appreciate that as a true artiste of this. There is no one way to do analysis. There's your way, and it works for you, but there's no one way.
Correct. I mean, you know, just because my style works for me doesn't mean it works for everybody else.
And so, flash forward, you're at Cowen. Were there a lot of women? I mean, what's funny is in my industry, well, I went from a company selling stuff, so it was like 40% women, to a hedge fund where I didn't have employees, but the back office was some women, but I had no women on the trade desk. And then it was a small firm. And then I go to the tech world, which is pretty much no women. And then crypto world, where they're like, oh, it's all going to be different. And it seems to be even less women. So you grew up in this era where were there women at Cowen with you?
There actually were. Surprisingly, there were quite a few. But I left Cowen in 89 and I went to Goldman.
And you were their first technical analyst.
I was. I can tell you a funny story about that if you'd like.
Yes.
I had met the head of administration at Goldman mm-hmm. when he was at the New York Stock Exchange. And when Goldman thought about hiring a technical analyst, he thought of me. So he contacted me and I said, okay, I would be very happy to come interview. Mm-hmm. And about 3 days before the interview, I get a call from his assistant. And would I be willing to put together a chart of General Motors and do whatever it is I do? I mean, that's how little they knew. And wait, this is even better. And they would send a runner over to pick it up.
Yeah.
I said, I could fax it.
In gold shoes.
No, we'll send a runner, right? So I did. And my bottom line was that if GM crossed 43.5, it looked to me like it was going to 46 or 47. Anyway, that was it. A few days later, I show up at the office and I meet the head of admin, whose name was John. And he says to me, I'm going to take you in to meet Bob Mnuchin. who, for those who don't know, he was the head of all trading at Goldman Sachs at
and
the time.
He's
maybe
Steve's
like the number three partner.
He's Steve's dad?
He is. He is Steve's dad.
Got it.
And but he was a big deal partner. He wasn't some low level guy. And he had this office that was like a fishbowl, sat in the middle of the trading floor.
Huh.
So they marched me across the trading floor into his office, and Bob Mnuchin had this really big voice, big booming voice. And I walked into the office, and before I could sit down, he said to me, "I'm long 100,000 shares of Motors." And I'm sure I turned white. And he looked at me and he said, "Aren't you the one who said if it goes through 43 and a half, it's going to 46 or 47? Uh-huh. And, you know, I don't even think I could speak at that point, I must say. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Have a seat. If you're going to work at Goldman, you're going to put your money where your mouth is."
Wow.
And back then, stocks didn't, you know, the Dow was trading at, I don't know, 2,500 or something like that. So stocks didn't move a dollar, and they certainly didn't move like they move now.
Got it.
And General Motors, being a $40 stock, certainly wasn't moving a dollar. And anyway, General Motors closed up 2.75 on the day. And quite frankly, I knew I had the job.
That is awesome. Canute.
That is fantastic.
Where's the sound effects?
Oh, no, that's right. Oh, yeah,
we rarely give these out, and you're just...
There we go.
See, those are great stories. This is what I wanted to get. Congratulations. How stressed you must have been.
I'm sure I was sweating.
Because Steve has bad breath. Did Bob have bad breath? I'm making this up, but it seems like the Mnuchins have bad breath. Like, supposedly you could melt your collar. No?
I have no idea, but I'll tell you a funny story he did tell me.
Is he still alive, Bob?
I think he is. I believe he is.
Well, then I feel bad that I've disgraced his name on my podcast. But he does work at Goldman, and...
He left. He left years ago. But he did tell me a very funny story that when he was, I think, 16 years old, he got a job working at like a traveling circus or traveling carnival.
Right.
And his job was to guess everybody's height and weight.
Wow. Well, let me guess yours. Because I feel you're 5'4". I'm going to say 5'4", 130. 120. 5'4", 120.
Okay, I'm 4'11".
4'11"? Were you in Game of Thrones? Were you a part actor in Game of Thrones?
I've never seen Game of Thrones, so that's going to go right over my head.
There's a lot of... It's an HBO show with a lot of small people. 4'11", wow.
4'11".
Wow. That's quite small. Short. So you're walking to the fishbowl with your GM technical analysis hocus pocus. Right. You had to be pooping your pants.
I was.
Wow.
Was
he a big guy, this Bob with the bad breath?
Yeah. Oh, I would say he was well over 6 feet.
Ooh. Well, good on you. The thing about this is the Mnuchins, the guy probably was a street kid.
Bob Mnuchin was a Yale graduate.
Oh, he was? Well, fuck him. So Bob hires you.
But there were a lot of other guys there who, you know, didn't have college degrees.
What I find about with people with Yale, which annoys me because I know many of them, is that what they lead with. You say, "Hey, I'm Howard. It's sunny outside. How's your day going?" "Well, I went to Yale." Did Bob do that?
I don't remember that he did.
Okay. So you do this trade. What was the war? So you killed it. I bet you your next one was a dog of an idea. What was your first dog that Goldman people were just like, "Stay away from me"?
Oh, God. So here's a really funny story. My first day of work, I show up. They give me a seat at the end of a trading desk. And because I have my charts, I need more room than other people.
And
nobody talks to me.
You open it up like a fishing tap, and you got a pencil and a thick pencil and tape.
A ruler. Don't forget the ruler. And nobody talks to me. I mean, you know, people are all sort of looking at me. Nobody introduces themselves.
Oy.
And at the end of the trading day, Bob Mnuchin comes out of his office, saunters across the trading floor. And when he walked on the trading floor, everybody looked up to see who he was going to talk to. And he comes over to me, pulls up a chair, and right before he sits down, in that big voice, he said, "That was one hell of a trade we had in GM, wasn't it?" And then he sits down to talk to me. The next day, everybody came over to shake my hand.
That's cool. So So what was your first horrific tray where you were scared to go back into the office?
Oh, God. There were so many, I can't even remember.
I know, but let people know that it happens. Like, do you ever some that just shook you?
Oh, yeah.
like, shook your confidence in pencil and tape?
Yes. I was bearish in... So I went to work at Goldman right after Labor Day, so it was...
And what did they pay back then? Do you mind saying, what was pay? $30,000 a year?
No, you know, I can't... I want to say.
Did you feel rich? Was 80. It an exciting?
I want to say it was 80.
That's real money.
Maybe it was 60. I don't remember. I
but
can't
you
remember.
Felt that was real pay. Money to you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Wow. So what's the worst trade? So I mean, what's the trade that shook you early?
So that was early September, and then in early October, I turned quite cautious on the market. And by then, people were talking to me, but they didn't really know me. It had only been like a month.
Right.
And and the market rallied almost 4 seconds after I declared that it was terrible. Okay. I mean, and it was like in a morning meeting, and I made this big declaration about how awful the market looked, and the market rallied. I don't even remember how much, but it was enough that I was mortified because it was my first really big call. And, you know, and I sat there watching the market rally like every single day. And I was like, oh, God, this is terrible.
Well, that'll help people. I think, you know, you're at Goldman. These are the stories people need to hear. You know, no one knows anything. And in the end, it's about risk management and about learning and getting cut and being bold. And there's no way to do this without risking your reputation. You just have to be consistent. I think one of my favorite lines, I have so many questions, sorry, because I've been a fan for so long. The most important thing, and you've pinned it to your Twitter profile because I laugh about it all the time, because you could basically wake up and just say this every day. It's like yoga. I find investing much like yoga. Everything sounds the same because it is the same. You know, it's risk. You got to repeat the mantra. And you say nothing like price to change sentiment. So let's take that apart, because that is like the biblical, the Old Testament of how markets work. Fear and greed, mood, etc. Why is that so important?
Well, I can give you the best example.
Mm-hmm.
You go shopping. I'll just pick Macy's because why not? And you
well,
see
you just,
a fabulous
you just pointed
sweater.
Out your age again. Could have said
and
Amazon.
I could have. But you see a fabulous sweater, right? Uh-huh. And the price is whatever, $100. And you don't buy it. And then they mark it down to 50 and you think you got a hell of a deal.
Uh-huh.
You're so excited. Let me run over there and get that sweater.
Mm-hmm.
The stock market is the only place where when they mark it down from 100 to 50, people say no, thank you.
Very true.
And that to me is the biggest difference. And that's how I can describe price changes sentiment. Whereas in everywhere else, when the price comes down, people get happier and more encouraged, and not on Wall Street.
I agree. And is this the trick that made Jack Bogle the man? The index allowed, here's what I think, forgetting the ETF, the index allowed people the ability, it allows bear market, the index is what allows me to still participate. Meaning, I find that in a bear market, stock picking is just, I might as well throw it out the window because I don't have enough time to spend actually doing work. Even though I have a strong network, I can call on anybody, but I still like to be in charge of my own money. I don't like to yell at other people for decisions I make. The buck stops with Howie. That's what's pinned to my tweet. No, but I'm going to pin that. So in that world, that was Bogle's genius. That the easiest way to get people to understand the market going down 50% was to have an index available to them. Because I'm telling you, like, I have stocks down 50% and I cut them because maybe I don't know.
Right.
And so do you think that was his trick? Like, how do you feel about indexes in a world of how you purely started in the business?
Well, let me start with the... Maybe I can take you back about 18 months ago in the market.
Please.
Early 2021... Everybody was having a great time.
Yes.
Money was flowing. stocks were going up. I mean, probably energy stocks may have been the only stocks that weren't participating. And everybody was loving life. NASDAQ at the time had well over 700 stocks making new highs, which I had never seen before. It was
a party.
It was a party.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a correction. And ever since then, a lot of those stocks entered a bear market and have never recovered.
Correct.
And so most of 2021, in my eyes, was a nifty 50 type of market because you had a smaller and smaller and smaller group of index moving stocks.
Correct.
That were lifting the index.
Mm-hmm. They masked the bear market. They masked the early part of the bear market.
Absolutely. I think we've been in a bear market since
March.
Since the first quarter of 2021.
Yes, you and JC. That's who I follow. I'm with you.
And I have said that, you know, the majority of stocks are in downtrends.
Yes.
I don't know what more of a definition we need. And so I think the majority of 2021 masked the index. So to go back to your question about indexing, mm-hmm. indexing was terrific last year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And now most people in 2022 have come to the realization that, yes, we're in a bear market, even though the S&P hasn't gone down that magical 20% yet.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is that, yes, we're in a bear market, but the stock picking is better now than it was last year.
Yeah. So, you know, we're in the second quarter. We are in a bear market. Indexes are below the 200-day. And finally, even I believe now the opposite will play out. People will open their statements, see they're in a bear market, and sell their indexes. And so I think the last stage of this, barring some kind of catastrophe, is Apple, Tesla, the things that held up the indexes get sold because people wake up and see because of the media. And so they believe it's a bear market. And I'm already starting to see it in some of my beaten down stocks. They're going up, even though Apple's now down and Tesla's down every day. I'm seeing some of my stocks, like Zillow, for example, bottomed at 30 and it's going up every day for now.
But that's how bases are built.
Yeah.
First, you have to have a rally. Then you have to come down again and retest, was that 30 a good level? And then you rally again. And then, you know, it's a long process. The top wasn't built in a day and the bottom isn't going to be built in a day either.
And so you're at Goldman and you end up on the internet with Jim Cramer. How does the internet affect you? How did you spot it so early? Because you're a legend. You were there at thestreet.com basically day one. What was it? Is it because you knew Jim?
I did. Jim had been one of those small hedge fund clients at Cowen in the late 80s.
Got it.
And so he and I chatted a lot. And he, having come from Goldman, knew nothing about technical analysis.
Ah.
So he would call me several times a day and we'd sort of go over it. And then we lost touch. Because I went to Goldman. And then in 1993, I left and I went to Minneapolis.
Huh.
And I took a job with Cargill.
Oh, wow. Internally at Cargill?
They had a financial markets division and they had an equity trading desk where I was going to have the opportunity to trade.
To hedge what, like ags and other
things? No, stocks.
Oh, okay.
Manage equity money, you know, internally for the company.
Got it.
And
what a cool job.
What
a terrible job.
you want to talk about a place that had no professional women.
Got it. Yeah.
Goldman had more than Cargill.
Got it. So they pluck you. You don't like it. And then Jim reaches out somehow?
No. And while I was there, I did happen to meet my husband in Minneapolis, who was an ag trader for Cargill. And in 1996, he got transferred to Singapore to set up Cargill's grain trading business there.
Mm.
So I quit and I said, I'm going to go. We've got the internet, even though it's dial up. I'll do some trading. I'm good.
Cool.
And while I was there, I read an article in New York Magazine by Jim Cramer that he was writing. He was doing maybe like a weekly column or something. And I reached out to him. Just, hi, Jim. Don't know if you remember me. It's been a lot of years. And of course he did. And he told me that he was starting The Street. And did I want to write, as he put it, one day a week just to keep my hand in it? I said, oh, what a great idea. And that's how it started.
Wow. Now, rumors he has bad breath. Is that true? I knew I could get you to laugh.
Maybe
it took too
I'm
long.
The one with the bad breath.
I don't know what I've heard. I'm just saying it to everybody. And so I'm very, like, my son, he puts on so much cologne. He was going out with his girlfriend. I mean, if you're listening, son, tone it down. I mean, I don't know what it is. All right, so Jim, we're not commenting on Jim's breath. So Jim, so you write for Real Money. You're part of, like, a wrecking crew of smart people, like Herb Greenberg, who's amazing,
yeah,
and Kodrowski, and Ritholtz. I don't know. Who was
Todd,
like,
Harrison was there.
Yeah, Kessler was writing for him.
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of really good people.
Oh, my God. It was incredible.
Days.
You guys were the first people to, like, open my eyes to the markets because it was just, like, affordable and not Bloomberg and live and real.
Yeah. It was fun. I mean, it's still fun. I love writing about markets. I love talking about markets. I love markets. What can I say?
What's the hardest market you've ever traded? Like, what was the one that, like, not a trade, but like a market that just shook you and said, I don't know?
I'll give you two.
Okay.
I'm not very good at V markets, markets that make a V bottom because the Fed pivoted.
Okay, so 2020 was bad.
2020, terrible. I caught the low. I was terrific. I kept looking for a retest. Never happened.
Got it.
Terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
Okay, fair.
And in this market, because I believe in a reversion to the mean, and I believe that nothing goes up or down in a straight line, I started late last week looking for a bear market rally. So far, you can see I'm wrong.
Got it. So,
and so I find this difficult because, my gosh, everything's lining up. It should work. And it's not so far.
Got it. And that's just markets, right? So then it just comes down to risk management and living to fight another day. Is that the best advice you can give?
Exactly. You know, when I would say when markets are, I'll use the word groping for a bottom in the market.
Ooh, hang on. All right, we're leading with this as a title. Helene gropes for a bottom. Film at 11. So, but I'm hearing you, so you're groping.
You know, you what you do is you keep trying. Yeah. You keep testing. And okay, oh, they
stopped
me.
Yeah, you throw it.
And then the next day's a brand new day, and you keep trying again. Okay, they stopped me. But you know it's in there, and you keep trying. Most people can't do that because they're like, my God, how many times can you be wrong? I'm like, I don't know. I could be wrong a gazillion times. But if I really have the confidence, which I do right now, I'm going to keep trying it.
Yeah.
Because all it means is I'm off by a few days or hopefully only off by a few days.
But we are in a bear market. The Fed is against. So meaning you may be off by a few days and we may get a 40% bounce, but we're in a bear market.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but I'm going to tell you, I won't know that we're at the end of the bear market until well after the fact. I'm
correct.
Not one of these people who declares that was the low because I won't know.
Yeah. And so today, how do you spend a day? Like, what does a day look like?
Do you want me to start with when I get up and I do Wordle?
Sure, because you're a professional and you love the market. So what does a day look like? Do you brush your teeth early? Like, would people say Elaine should really brush her teeth at 8 a.m., not 8 p.m.?
Well, you know, it's that bad breath thing going on.
No, but you can trade alone now, so who gives a shit about hygiene? No, so what does a day look like?
Oh, I get up pretty early. I would say between 4 and 5 a.m.
Me too.
And
okay.
I check markets, mm-hmm, obviously, and I see what's going on. And then I start to read. I like to read the news. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of fresh. And I do that without getting up and going to my desk. I work from home. I have a dedicated room that's my office. I have for 25 years. And I usually don't get up and go to my desk until after 6 o'clock. Because I don't want to sit in the chair so many hours.
Yep.
And then I'll check my emails. I don't check my emails before I go to the desk because I don't want to get upset. And that's it. And then, you know, and then I'll check some statistics from the night before that I hadn't had a time to do before I signed off at night. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything interesting, I probably tweet it out. And then this time of the year, then I go for my bike ride around 6:30 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I come back and I get back. I take my shower and everything. And then I get back to the desk and I generally stay at the desk most of the day. I do run errands in the middle of the day. And people who follow me on Twitter will know that I will generally announce when I'm off the desk because the market tends not to like that.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. And then the market closes at 3 o'clock here. And then I sit down and, as we've discussed, I actually still chart, stocks by hand with a pencil and paper.
And you're about 200 at any one time a day that you're following?
No, it's between 150 and 200.
Got it. And how long does that take? 2 hours?
No, 45 minutes.
45 minutes. Got it. So you
end. On a day where the market is really wild and I have to like recalculate some of the scales because we've had a big day in the market, It takes a little longer, but
got it.
You know.
And you find that's your meditation, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So you go through that rhythm. How do you know when to add a different name and take out a different name? Like, how do you decide on, you know?
That's a good question.
Because energy has kind of seeped into our consciousness late, could be early, we don't know. How do you switch from having probably 100?
I don't switch.
Oh, you don't switch. Okay.
No, I have a set pile of charts. And because every day, all I'm doing is that day's high, low, and close.
Got it.
So, you know, if I start a new chart, I have no pattern to look at.
Got it.
So, you know, I'd have to guess off the top of my head. I'd probably do 7 to 10 energy stocks. And so even when they're garbage, I do them.
Got it.
And I used to joke with my mentor who taught me how to do this. He would take a pile of charts home with him and he would leave me a pile of charts. And then when he'd come back to the office, he'd go through my pile of charts and take the interesting ones and leave me with the dull ones. And I used to say to him, why do I always get the dull charts? And he said, because you're going to be the one who tells me when they start getting better.
Got it. Because going through the dull ones, I'm sure going back a year and a half, there were moments on those dull ones that someone could have rung a bell and say, well, what's going on here? Did you catch that or did someone catch that?
Yeah. I mean, I've been on the energy bandwagon for a while, so I guess I would say yes. But again, how did energy bottom? Let's go back to your growth stocks for a minute. How did energy bottom? You know, we had negative oil and the energy stocks were terrible at the 2020 low. And then you had a big rally and then they came down again. And in late 2020, I think it was, I want to say it was like November 2020 or sometime around there, they retested, most of them retested those lows.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came up again. But then the next time down, they made a higher low.
Right.
And that's how you start to see basis form. But look at, I mean, we're talking over a year before they actually had ups and downs where you could call it a base.
Yeah. No, fantastic. And there's no shortcuts.
That's what'll happen. Yeah. No.
There's no shortcuts.
That's why I hate V-bottoms.
Yeah. 2020, I got. 2021, I got. I got out. 2022 got me because I don't do technical really. And I was, you know, when stocks were down 50%, I was like, well, I know everything's overvalued, but I think I've just, luckily for me, it's not the end of the world because I have such a high cash position, but I can feel the pain out there. Do you have a group on Twitter that, who do you like following?
Let me tell you something.
Because I know you like to kid around with me and you have a great sense of humor, obviously, because I'm there goofing off, but also trying to point people to.
We all are.
Yeah, but I'm trying to point people to greatness and you're one of the greats. Who do you banter with around markets?
Before we get to that, let me just say that one of the things that I think is underappreciated is how much pain yesterday brought.
Huh. Tell me why.
And I'll tell you why. Okay. Why? Because yesterday they got to almost every single hidey hole.
Yeah, they got to Target.
Target.
They got to Costco.
They got to Walmart. They got to Costco. But not only
Union
that.
Union Pacific. They got to the railroads.
They got to the railroads. Right. The transports had been holding. Yeah. And they got to the transports. They got to the food stocks. They got to all the supposedly dividend stocks. They even killed the energy stocks for a day.
Mm-hmm.
I often call it a realization day. So I think yesterday, Wednesday, May 18th, was the day that people sort of realized, my gosh, there's something not right here.
Yeah. And today, Apple's down. Tesla's still down, but a lot of the beaten up stuff is rallying. So this is the day that like people will start selling their indexes because the media will pick up on the Costcos and the Home Depots and the Walmarts. And I just think now the indexes catch up to the carnage. Maybe, I hope I'm wrong. I hope the markets only go up for the rest of time. You know, when we started Panic with Friends, I didn't know it was going to be a V-bottom, but I just knew VIX 80. If you're not going to buy stocks at VIX 80, you may not ever buy a stock. Like, I was like telling people, like, I don't know what to tell you people, like, this, that's a panic. Today doesn't feel like a panic. It just feels like stocks are catching up to the realization, or other stocks are catching up to the realization of that there's a tech wreck. I'm not sure how this plays out, but we're getting closer to some kind of tradable bottom for sure.
But let me go back to that talk on capitulation and panic that everybody seems to be looking for. My God, people who I've never heard talk about it before, all of a sudden, oh, we need capitulation. Like, do you even know what that looks like? I mean, you know, up through last Thursday, we spent, I don't know, several years before that, where the triple Qs didn't trade barely more than 50 million shares on a day. Okay. And in 2022, they have traded on average over 100 million shares almost every single day. What more selling do you want? My God, it doesn't have to happen in a day. There has been a lot of selling going on.
A lot.
Like, what are you waiting for?
Yeah.
I mean, you have double the amount of volume in the first 5 months of this year than you had all of last year.
Yeah. So there is liquidity. The question becomes, I was listening to Jan Van Eck, who I just follow the markets a lot, and his firm manages like $80 billion. And really, we're going to learn a lot next month, he says, in June, when they stop buying.
Yes.
And so I really have got June on my calendar for chaos.
Yeah. I have to say, I have had it as sort of my pick as well. But part of me, and I'm going to admit this now, and I've not said this before, but part of me keeps thinking about the first Iraq war. We entered January 1991, and everybody knew there was that deadline of January 15th. Huh. And the market kept going down. You know, we had made a low in August, we rallied, we made a lower low in October, we rallied, and then we started to come down again in January. And there was this deadline, January 15th. Hmm. And everybody talked about it. And I remember, it was at Goldman at the time, and I remember coming into the morning meeting that Monday morning. I think we went to war on Tuesday. On that Monday morning, and I said, if you don't know that we're going to war, what are you waiting for? Isn't that what the selling of the last few weeks is about? And I keep remembering that. And of course, if those who don't know, we did make a low on the bombs falling and we rallied thereafter. And now I grant you the Fed was tightening then and the Fed pivoted about a week or two later to loosening. But my point is who doesn't know that June?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And maybe that's what all the selling recently has been about.
Yeah. Yeah. Nah, really
I don't
good
know,
check.
But it's just something that I keep thinking about is it too well telegraphed?
Orchestrated. And the smart money is just finally repositioning ahead of June. From your lips to God's ears. Listen, by the way, Johnny Carson picked a co-host. I know you're busy, but when I'm sick, you step in. So it doesn't pay well. But Knut has hired you as a stand-in. So
Knut is terrific.
Knut is terrific.
Thank you. Can I have that in writing,
handsome.
Please?
We need to get a picture of you standing next to Knut and for the carnival.
Right.
And we'll send it to Bob. We'll send it to Bob from your carnival days. Me and Knut. I appreciate that you get the whole sense of humor. The markets, are the funniest place on earth. They are human drama, human emotion, human mistakes, the joy of profits and victory, and the fear and greed and panic.
Agony of defeat.
There's no defeat. There's defeat for people that double down and triple down and use leverage as a strategy. There is defeat looming, right? And that was what 08 was about, is like financial leverage is a nice tactic. And that's, you know, it's not a strategy for all times. And I think part of the crypto thing is they think they understand leverage. They don't. And so there's...
I'm not sure they understand a lot.
Well, good point. But they definitely don't understand leverage.
Let me not go down that road. I just, I'm not a crypto fan. I probably never will be. I'm too old probably for that. But, as I'm fond of saying, I can find plenty of ways to lose money in stocks. I don't need to do it in crypto.
Correct. That's a great way to end it. I got to have you back. Did you have fun?
I did. Thank you.
Yeah. Just fantastic to finally talk with you. And hopefully it was pleasant enough that we can get you back in other crazy moments in the market.
It was lovely. Thank you. And next time I'll have something ready on the panic side.
Oh, no, don't worry. Exactly. It's more around your expertise, which I think our audience will really appreciate. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Well, people may not know her, but now they do.
Yes.
Were you surprised?
Me? No, I'm not surprised that she is very
knowledgeable. Well, you've talked to her before, yeah. Since she was lovely.
But I didn't know of her. But then again, I don't know a lot of the people in this business. So.
Right. But did you learn something?
Oh, always. And from her, definitely.
Yes. Can you imagine the stories?
Oh, yeah.
But also, the stories are how you learn. Like, you walk into Bob's office and he says, I got 100,000 shares. So you're now more stressed is when other people tell you what they... This is why I don't like to tell people. I only like to tell people what I'm doing. When that guy told her what he was doing, that increased the stress in her life and changes how she looks at the market. So there's all this weird dynamics
right. That
you have to deal with when running people's money and being an analyst, et cetera. So these are how markets work. Anyways, I really enjoyed that. She's a legend. Every day she's on Twitter, FinTwit, talking about this stuff and has a great sense of humor, which is important to me. So you are listening to Panic with Friends. We sit down with traders, investors, people in the financial industry, venture capitalists, and we try and get a little bit ahead about trends. And obviously the name of the show, Panic with Friends, in the rare moments and times like we are in May of 2022 in a panic or in the beginnings or end of a panic or the moment that panic feels like it's upon us, we like to sit down with people that have been through them before to kind of steer us and guide us, if you will. So you can go to Google, Spotify, Apple, search my name, Howard Lindzen. You can subscribe to Panic with Friends, and every Thursday, get a podcast without having to think about things. Thanks, Knut. See everybody next week.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.